We are in the midst of an eight-week series on the history of the RPCNA. That's the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America. This is week number six. We've covered quite a lot of ground so far. When you study Presbyterianism, you have to go back to Scotland because that's where Presbyterianism first came from. So we started with the Reformation, how the Protestant Reformation came to Scotland through the likes of Patrick Hamilton and John Knox and people like that. We saw that after the first Reformation in Scotland, we saw the struggle between Presbyterianism and prelacy that happened between King James and later his son King Charles and the Scottish Presbyterians. When Charles came to the throne, he pushed the envelope too far in a way, resulting in the revolt. Remember, Jane Geddes threw the stool at the minister in St. Giles and started this revolution, and really the Second Reformation in Scotland. That resulted in the National Covenant, the Solemn League and Covenant, and that time of that time, Oliver Cromwell comes to power in England around that time. We studied the church under him a little bit, and then he dies. His son can't retain the power, and they bring back the royalty, bring back Charles II. He and his brother James are the ones who really persecute the Scottish Covenanters, and that happened from 1660 through 1688, culminating in that period of time called the Killing Times. We looked at that in detail. William and Mary of Orange from the Netherlands come and sort of take the throne away from James, and Great Britain is happy to give it to them. And they do that in 1688 in the Glorious Revolution or the Bloodless Revolution. And that's when the persecution stops. We saw how William of Orange allowed the Church of Scotland to become Presbyterian. And again, it had been Anglican under Charles and James. But now it's Presbyterian again. But we saw there were still some issues with it. That the Covenanters refused to be a part of it. They stayed away. They became a dissenting body and eventually became their own official church, the Reformed Presbytery. We followed that forward into from Scotland to Northern Ireland. Remember that most people moved from Scotland to Northern Ireland first, and that's where they picked up the Scotch-Irish, and then from there they came to America. We looked at the early history of the RPs in America. I remember John Cuthbertson. He was the only minister in the U.S. for, I think, 23 years, and he was responsible for, you know, Pennsylvania, New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, a huge area, and he did all that on horseback, was kind of an itinerant minister. And you remember the stories he had and his journal where he baptized over 1,000 Covenanter babies. He had that one account of staying in someone's home and didn't sleep at all because there are too many bugs and those kind of things. So he was quite the adventurer. That story sticks with me. I hate bugs. So we followed that up. We briefly touched on what happens right after the Revolutionary War, where actually a large portion of the Covenanters join with the Associate Presbytery, the Seceder group, and we'll talk about that more, and that's what we'll get into today. But first, I wanted to consider the kind of Presbyterian in general, not just RPs, but more broad Presbyterian, and the effect on the founding of the United States. It's pretty amazing how influential it was. All of Scottish Presbyterians are coming over in droves at this time. And remember, there's kind of three groups. There's the mainline Presbyterians, which are the official Church of Scotland. That's the biggest group. They're coming over. There's the Associate Presbytery, which is the Seceders. They're coming over. And then there's the Reformed Presbytery, which is the Covenanters, and they're coming over. So three different groups are immigrating to America, and thousands of each group are coming over just constantly. And some of the Covenanters came earlier because they had been banished and exiled, but most came looking just like everyone else, looking for more freedom, looking for more economic opportunity. One example, in 1685, and that's during the Killing Times in Scotland, a group leaves Scotland led by a man named Ninian Beale. And he founds a Scottish colony, and it's actually interesting. It didn't last, I don't think, but this colony was on the geographical location that would eventually become Washington, D.C. So it's just kind of interesting that a lot of history wrapped up there. But the Scottish Presbyterians, all those three groups, came primarily to Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And I'm going to read these two first quotes in your outlines there, number one and number two. This is J.D. Douglas first talking about New Jersey and then Pennsylvania. So the first one about New Jersey. This part of the Atlantic seaboard consequently acquired and for long retained a strong Scottish and Presbyterian character. The descendants of these Presbyterians had much to do with the foundation and prosperity of the College of New Jersey in 1774, which grew to be Princeton University. Okay, so that's sort of a Presbyterian college. We won't talk about where it's gone since then, but it started as a Presbyterian seminary, which is kind of sad. But then on to Pennsylvania. Douglas speaking again about Pennsylvania. Before the outbreak of the American Revolution, the numerical strength of the Presbyterians increased so rapidly as a result of their Scotch-Irish immigration that this religious group became increasingly important in the affairs of the province of Pennsylvania. In 1774, Benjamin Franklin, computing total population of, and this should actually say Philadelphia, of 350,000, estimated that Scotch-Irish accounted for one-third of that number. Allowing for the fact that not all Scotch-Irish were Presbyterians, one would consequently place the number of Presbyterians in Philadelphia at the close of the colonial era in the neighborhood of 100,000. Okay, so it's tremendously influential in Philadelphia, which is a key place for the Revolution. And that covenant, you know, the Covenanters all along here have this you know, position that the British government is illegitimate and it's wrong and they have all this thing. And so now all these Presbyterians are coming over to America, and that view that the British government's illegitimate and doesn't have a right to rule over us, that's contagious and really spreads like wildfire in America, especially with the ocean separating you from the British government and things like that. And to give you one example of that, we hadn't spoken about this man yet, but Alexander Craighead was actually a Covenanter minister before John Cuthbertson, but he was a Covenanter for a while and then actually left the Covenanter church. But he came to America in the 1740s, and let me read quote number three there from J.D. Douglas. A section of the Covenanters, led by the Reverend Alexander Craighead in the first half of the 18th century, renewed their covenants, declaring not only their religious convictions, but also their right to civil independence. Indeed, the followers of Craighead made a public demand for national independence from Great Britain. They circulated the daring doctrine. It breathed the spirit of the early Scottish Covenanter manifestos. From this bold statement of rights and principles, the writer of America's Declaration of Independence admits that he received aid and drew inspiration. So he's talking about Thomas Jefferson there. So very influential. What he's talking about there is something called the Mecklenburg Declaration. And Alexander Craighead had come to Pennsylvania first and moved around, eventually left the Covenanter Church, but had gone to Virginia and eventually settled in what became Charlotte, North Carolina. And he and other community leaders in that settlement put together this declaration called the Mecklenburg Declaration. And I'll read it here. It's quote number four, and you might see some similarities with our own Declaration of Independence. Resolved that we, the citizens of Mecklenburg County, do hereby dissolve the political bands which have connected us to the mother country, and hereby absolve ourselves from all allegiance to the British Crown, and abjure all political connection, contract, or association with that nation who have wantonly tramped on our rights and liberties and inhumanely shed the innocent blood of American patriots at Lexington. That we do hereby declare ourselves a free and independent people are, and of right ought to be, a sovereign and self-governing association under the control of no power other than that of our God and the general government of the Congress, to the maintenance of which independence we solemnly pledge to each other our mutual cooperation, our lives, our fortunes, and our most sacred honor. And there's some debate among historians, but I read accounts where it said that Mecklenburg Declaration was on Thomas Jefferson's desk when he's writing. The other people say, I don't know about that. But there's obviously some sense of influence. I think Billy Graham actually in a sermon talked about Thomas Jefferson having that declaration on his desk. But again, that's sort of up for debate. But again, the point is we're saying the Covenanters and Presbyterian in general had a tremendous influence on the founding of this country. To kind of continue on there, most of what follows here is from a blog post recently put up by Don Sweeting. He's a president of the Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando, Florida, but he had put this post up on July 4th, and I found it pretty neat. But he was saying, at the time of the Revolutionary War, it's estimated about 3 million people live in the American colonies. Okay, and of that amount, 900,000 were Scottish or Scotch-Irish Presbyterians, 600,000 were English Puritans, and 400,000 were Dutch or German Huguenots. Okay, so that's 1.9 million that come from a Calvinistic heritage, John Calvin, and that's almost two-thirds. That's an incredible percentage. And so the colonies were really tremendously Calvinistic. Let me read. I have quotes 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 are all these quotes about this time, and I think it's pretty fascinating. So quoting from one historian, number 5, when Cornwallis was driven back to ultimate retreat and surrender at Yorktown, all of the colonels of the colonial army but one were Presbyterian elders. It is estimated that more than one half of all the soldiers and officers of the American army during the Revolution were Presbyterian. Okay? So take that for what it's worth. And many Presbyterian ministers would often support the Revolution from their pulpits and their sermons and things and kind of go on the record publicly about that. And many of those churches ended up being burnt to the ground by the British troops kind of in response to that in what they did. And consider the other quotes from observers of the Revolutionary War. There was a colonist, he lives in America, but he's loyal to King George, and he's writing a letter to friends back in England. He said, I fix all the blame of these extraordinary proceedings upon the Presbyterians. Okay. And number 7, Lord Dartmouth, who was the Secretary of State for the colonies at one point, he has a representative in the state of, in New York, and that representative has said, Presbyterianism is really at the bottom of this whole conspiracy, has supplied it with vigor, and will never rest until something is decided upon it. And then a Hessian captain in the English army, number 8, call this war by whatever name you may, only call it not an American rebellion, it is nothing more or less than a Scotch-Irish Presbyterian rebellion. And then there was a man named Horace Walpole, he was a member of the English House of Commons. And he's talking about the American Revolution in a speech in their parliament. He says, there is no good crying about the matter. Cousin America has run off with the Presbyterian parson, and that is the end of it. Okay. And he's actually referring specifically to a man named John Witherspoon, who was a Presbyterian minister, not an RP, but just a Presbyterian minister. At this time, he was the president of the College of New Jersey, which would become Princeton. And he was actually the only clergyman to sign the Declaration of Independence. So all that to say, there's no question that Presbyterians had a lot to do with the Revolutionary War, a lot to do with the founding of the country. And it's neat. And you can see that why, we've studied their history of their struggle with the British crown back in Scotland and things. And it's no surprise that when they came to America, they were ready to let go of the burden of the British government. So that is kind of that, looking at the influence Presbyterianism in general had on the Covenanters. During that time of revolution, the Covenanters are sort of in lockstep with all other Presbyterians because, you know, they all agree we need to get rid of Britain, we need to throw off, and we need to start our own nation. And so they were happy to fight in the Revolutionary War. They were, you know, happy to oppose Britain and all that. But now what happens is, you know, as the colonies are starting to win the war and they're starting to realize, hey, this is a thing. This is going to, you know, we're going to have a new nation here. The Covenanters are now kind of, you know, given this question. Do we, you know, are we going to be perfectly fine with politically participating in this new government of America? Or, you know, we haven't in Britain because we, you know, of our things, we've been political dissenters. Can we participate now in this new nation? And actually, you know, it happened in 1782 that all the pastors of the Covenanters and about half the people decided that political dissent didn't need to happen anymore in America. And so they joined with the seceders because that's the only thing separating them and formed the Associate Reformed Reformed Presbyterian Church, but there's a half of the group that stays out. And you know, why that was, we'll get into. But I wanted to just kind of study a little bit more the difference in the view of government between covenanters and seceders. And remember, this is the only difference between these two churches at the time. Every other doctrine, every worship practice, everything is exactly the same. The only thing that divides them is this issue. And so, it's all over the issue of the mediatorial kingship of Christ, which says, let me give you a very brief explanation of what that means. Is it's saying, yes, God is creator of the world, is already king of the world. There's no question there. He's triune God. He's creator of the world. But when Christ humbles himself and comes down to the world as the God-man, he lives and he dies for our sins. He conquers sin and death in his resurrection. And then after that, when he ascends to heaven, he's given all authority in heaven and earth because of his great act of salvation. Okay, so Christ then is sort of doubly ruler of the universe. First, as part of God, as part of the triune God, he is king of the universe. But now, as victorious Savior, as prophet, priest, and king, he is given this sort of mediatorial or representative power over the universe. And the slide tries to show that on the left there. And what that means is that all things on earth are under Christ's authority. So that means civil governments, not just the church, but civil governments, all, you know, every aspect of life. And because of that, civil governments then are required really to acknowledge Christ as their king, acknowledge him as their Lord, and really even promote his church. And that was the, you know, that's a very short summary of the mediatorial kingship of Christ, but that was what it was. And the seceders' view was a little different than that, and I'm hoping this shows it a little bit, where the seceders thought of government as simply, you know, it's an ordinance that God created, you know, during creation. It was for the common benefit of mankind, and it was sort of the laws of nature that God had instituted that governed governments. And yes, government was under the authority of God as creator, but this power that Christ has given as mediatorial king was limited to the church, limited to, you know, those that Christ would save. And it wasn't meant to be this sort of all-inclusive thing. And so what that meant, how that came out in application is, you know, the seceders were okay with submitting to a government that wouldn't acknowledge Christ as king and things like that. And so obviously with America and even with Britain, they were okay to submit to the government, even though the government was refusing to acknowledge Christ as king. The Covenanters' views, which did hold to the mediatorial kingship, you know, and if you think of Matthew 28:18, which says Christ is talking to his disciples before goes up, and it's the Great Commission. He says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me," and that's what we're talking about. This special authority given to Christ because of his act of salvation, and that includes the governments of the world. And so there was something more than just governments or an ordinance created by God that fall under the normal laws of nature, but that they're required to acknowledge Christ and seek to follow the Bible as the kind of the ultimate rule of authority and things. So there's the difference, okay? And we could get into that a lot more, and there's books written on that, but hopefully, you know, between what I've said and that, you get some sort of idea. It's pretty technical difference, right? It's like, but what happens is how it comes out in application is covenanters won't vote, won't hold office, won't do this. Seceders will. And that was a big enough difference at the time to keep them separate. But and in Britain, and then when they come to America, the same question arises. Well, you know, we don't have the problems of the British government. We have this new nation. Can we participate in this new nation? Half the covenanters said yes, half said no. The half that said yes joined with the seceders to form the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church. So going on then, and for a time there, this the half of the covenanters that refused to join in with the Associate Reformed Presbyterian Church, they didn't really have very well thought out reasons of why they did it. It seemed to be sort of almost a tradition thing. Well, we can't, you know, we have this separation between us. How can we? And it wasn't until a few years later when the Constitution of the U.S. is written that they're sort of given the reason of why they can't. And so I want to consider that now, looking at the Covenanters and the U.S. Constitution. So before the Constitution is written and drafted and signed and ratified and everything, the Covenanters that stay out of the ARP are sort of unsure of their practice of political dissent. they're hopeful. You know, if Presbyterians have had this much influence on the Revolutionary War, perhaps we'll have that much influence on the founding of this nation. It can be this kind of Christian government, Christian nation that acknowledges Christ and all this. But quoting now from number 10 in your outline, this comes from Bill Edgar, who's a pastor in our church, actually in Philadelphia, living today. It's just funny that he's in Philadelphia. But let me quote number 10. He says, "With French help, the Americans won. A new nation emerged. Reformed Presbyterians no longer needed to dissent from ecclesiastical and political establishment that denied the covenants. Then the states ratified a new constitution, written in secret in Philadelphia in 1787. The Covenanters were aghast at its secularism. Governments of Christian lands had acknowledged Christ's reign since Roman times, but the United States Constitution conspicuously omitted any reference to God or Christ. In Scotland, the main issue had been the independence of the Christian church from a professedly Christian king. In America, the issue was the government's wholesale denial of Christ's authority over the nations." Okay, so you see the difference now. This Constitution, which, you know, I think we all like our Constitution in a way, the Covenanters couldn't stand it because they said, we're a Christian nation made up of Christian people, and we've just made this, you know, this Constitution the foundation of our government, and it, you know, it's written, and it has absolutely no acknowledgement of God. And how does it start? We the people. It's saying, we the people, you know, the democratic process, that is the ultimate authority. There's no acknowledgement of Christ or God as being ultimate king, and then we're under that. It's we the people. And that was very on purpose, you know, because you look back even to Roman times, all governments in the West to that point had acknowledged God, acknowledged Christ in their constitutions, and now the American Constitution stops that. And, you know, Bill Edgar talks about the Constitution being written in secret, you know, and that it sort of wasn't the will of the people at the time. You know, I don't know all about that, but it is interesting that, you know, that I never thought of that way of how secular they viewed the Constitution, because I think today we just love the Constitution. And it's just interesting that it had that history of really being this secular document. The Covenanters, their view had never been, the reason they thought Charles and James were illegitimate rulers wasn't because they were being persecuted. It was because they were not Presbyterian. And so the Covenanter, well, they acknowledged God, but they wanted to be Anglican and things like that. So the Covenanters all along were saying, we want our nation to be a Presbyterian nation. And even when William and Mary come and get rid of the persecution, they still won't acknowledge William and Mary as legitimate rulers because they're not Presbyterian. So I agree. It's sort of like, you know, you almost have to take off our 21st century perspective and say, man, that was a different way of thinking. But that at least the Covenanters, when they came to America, their hope had been to have a professedly Christian nation. They wouldn't want to persecute, but they certainly would want the government to promote the church and things like that. And we'll actually get into that here in a little bit. So it's a different way to think. I'll give you that. And honestly, in the next week too, I'll look at this. But you know, when you look back on this, it's hard to grapple with it and stuff. And what's interesting is our church has changed on this over the years, I think because of all that. And sort of, you know, you could say America is sort of this great experiment of having freedom of religion. And now we've had a couple hundred years of that. And where are we at now? And is that good or is it bad and all that stuff? So, yeah, it's fascinating stuff, I think. Any other comments before we move on? So, anyway, James, that's a good point about we should have Bill Edgar come out here and talk. Yeah. But let me go back to so yeah, I should have known my audience better, huh? So, but there's a man, James McKinney, and he's kind of key to all of this. He's give you his background. He's ordained as an RP minister in Northern Ireland in 1783, okay? So remember, all the Americans, or half the Covenanters, leave the Covenanter Church in 1782, and so he becomes a minister a year later in Northern Ireland, and he's aware of all this kind of turmoil and stuff happening in America. And so he really wants to go to America to be a minister there. The Covenanters no longer have ministers in America. But Northern Ireland's hurting for ministers too, and they say, no, we need you here. And so he stays for a while. We previously mentioned the United Irishmen. They're kind of a precursor to the IRA. And like other pastors, because McKinney's this big proponent of political dissent, the British government starts assuming that he's part of the United Irishmen, which really gets him in trouble. And actually, he's forced to flee to America to avoid being arrested and things like that. So he gets to go to America, and eventually he comes to America in 1793. And it was really McKinney who helped. You know, the Covenanters are sort of not sure what to do. It's McKinney who's the one who establishes the Covenanter position, really makes the argument. And let me read quote number 11. This comes from D.A. Carson, who was a political science professor at Geneva for years and has kind of written a history on this. But reading from him, the American Constitution had been written and ratified, and most of the states had written new constitutions. McKinney attacked these new constitutions at two points. First, their secular nature, and second, the idea that government should openly tolerate religious error and heresy. Under McKinney, therefore, a remnant of the church maintained its position of dissent from the government, but shifted the basis of that dissent from the Solemn League and Covenant and the Revolution Settlement in Scotland to the secular nature of the new American Constitution. This marked a new intellectual beginning for the church and was the answer to the question of the relationship of the Scottish church to the United States that satisfied the remnant of the society people. Okay, so McKinney is the one who sort of develops this argument. Shortly after that, in 1803, Samuel B. Wiley comes over as well. He's another Covenanter minister, and he publishes a book called The Two Sons of Oil, and that's referring in Zechariah 4. There's two anointed ones there. There's Zerubbabel, the governor, and Joshua, the priest, and it's the idea of God is anointing both. And, you know, one is over government, one is over the church. And so The Two Sons of Oil is all about the idea of church and the state and all that, and the fact that they're both under Christ. Samuel B. Wiley sort of publishes this, and that's sort of everything McKinney has been espousing is sort of laid out in this book. And in that book, it's a little more developed, and they give five reasons why they continue their practice of political dissent, why they refuse to participate in the U.S. government. First, the U.S. Constitution does not recognize the existence of God, and we can talk about the legitimacy of that one. But I think these other ones are definitely, whether we agree with them or not, they're more true. The Constitution did establish a toleration of religion, which recognizes heresy on an equal footing with truth. The Constitution does not provide for the interests of the true religion, and similar to that, Constitution does not require a religious test for office holders. So you could become an office holder in the government without being a Christian or passing a religious test or something. And then this fifth one, which we'll get into a lot next week, is the Constitution recognized the principle of slavery. Okay, so the Constitution doesn't say slavery is wrong or something like that. It allowed for it, and that was very bothersome to the Covenanters. Remember their history, that many of them had been exiled and sent to America as slaves back in the killing times. So anyways, you see this difference, this change. You know, political dissent remains from Scotland to America, but it changes in how it's done. If you recall, in Scotland and Ireland, political dissent meant complete dissent from anything related to the British government. You couldn't swear oaths of allegiance. You couldn't enlist in the army. You couldn't hold office in the government. You couldn't even pray for God's blessing on the government as long as it remained in its current state, you know, didn't repent from what it was doing. You couldn't utilize the courts for lawsuits. You couldn't vote. And even for a while, they said you couldn't pay taxes. But remember, we said no Covenanter owned property, all taxes were based on property, so that was more theoretical than practical. And that changed over time, probably, as they started, you know, it's easy to say we won't pay taxes, and then the tax bill comes. So that's where they're at, very extreme political dissent. In America, that continues somewhat. You know, you weren't allowed to swear oaths of allegiance, you weren't allowed to hold office in government, you weren't allowed to vote. And I have a quote there from Carson talking about that. But I think it was more passive. It was a little bit more about, in Scotland and Ireland, it had been about, I'm going to publicly profess the illegitimacy of this government, you know, anytime I can. This government is wrong, it's wrong, it's wrong, and I'm going to live my life like that, and I'm going to tell everybody I can about that. In America, it's a little bit more about, I'm going to live my life peaceably and submissive to this government, but for my conscience sake, I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to hold office because of the same kind of things, but it was a lot more passive, not as aggressive as it had been in Scotland and Ireland. And so there is a change there. I do want to get into this because what happens is distinctive of political dissent becomes more and more kind of refined, and it really gets to this point where it's a seven-step kind of logical argument why we can't vote. That's what it's trying to say. And this state, and you know, this is sort of the opinion or the view of the church until the 1960s. I think 1967 is when this finally is taken out, and we'll get into that next week. But let me walk through this. And this is sort of, I took one logic course in like seventh grade, so. But apparently this is a logical sequence. Each one of these is supposed to be a true statement, and then each one is built upon the other. I think that's logic. So take it for what it is. Anyways, so the first one is, the first kind of statement of truth is that Jesus Christ possesses all authority in heaven and on earth. And that's really the doctrine of mediatorial kingship of Christ. We got that, you know, we saw it in the Great Commission where he says that. Number two is that the civil government ought to acknowledge the authority of Jesus Christ. And in America's case, that's via the Constitution. It depends on your form of government, but in America, that would be in the Constitution. With James caveat the third one is that the U.S. Constitution does not recognize the authority of Jesus Christ. And then the fourth, an oath to support, defend the Constitution implies the oath taker's acceptance of the unscriptural principles of the U.S. Constitution. And therefore, taking that oath would be sinful. That was and actually that fourth one in 1967 is the one that is questioned and removed. And once you take one of these out, the whole thing kind of falls. And that's why we'll get into that. It's really fascinating how that happened. But so the fourth one is kind of the key one, saying taking that oath is you implying that you're okay with the Constitution, not acknowledging Christ, and that's sinful. That was the view. And then the five, six, and seven are kind of obvious. Office holders of the U.S. government are required to take that oath. Therefore, if you same thing. It's sinful to hold office if you can't, if you would have to take this oath. And then the sixth one is that a voter is morally responsible for the actions of its elected representative. You know, thinking if I vote for this person, they're going to have to take this oath. If I can't take this oath, how could I force them to take that oath? And that's how they got there. So you couldn't vote. You couldn't take the oath. You couldn't hold office, and then you couldn't vote for others to hold office. And that was the church, viewing all those as sinful, said you cannot do that. That was requirement as part of your membership vows that you would not participate in that way. So that was the stance of the church all the way up until the 1960s, which a lot of things changed in the 60s. And that's the other. We talked about the Christian Amendment. The other thing, they had this explanatory declaration, which we'll get into next week, which basically, when you read the oath, you said this explanatory declaration before it that sort of ensured that you weren't. And that's what led to getting rid of it, because it sort of got to the point where it gets complicated. I can't get – there are a lot of caveats, yeah. They would try to get things – cases – before like U.S. courts, and they were trying to get to the Supreme Court and never got there, but trying to have the court say, hey, by taking this oath, we as the government don't think you're, compromising your allegiance to Christ. That's what they wanted. They wanted the government to say you're not, and if they could get that, then there's no issue. Number four goes away, and that's actually, they got that a few times, I think, and that helped in that process. So it's a real technical, complicated thing, but I think it's fascinating. And the rightness and wrongness of it, it's easy to look back, and I think, I'd love to go back in a time machine and figure it out, but I'd probably be buying, a stock of companies. If I went back in a time machine, I wouldn't be worried about this stuff. So we already sort of talked on this, but this whole idea of McKinney, they said it on this slide. Number two, toleration of heresy and error. Number three, promoting the true religion. Number four, religious tests for office holders. Those seem so odd to us today. And I think we do. We need to take off our 21st century perspective and realize when they were living. And the one thing I would say is I don't think the Covenanters at least ever would want to persecute. That was never the thing. It was about we want to promote. And there was no, I mean, the Covenanters really never had the chance to be in power to show that they wouldn't persecute. But I don't think it went that far. And there's a big, you know, the spectrum of persecution and promoting a church by a government, that's a big spectrum, and I think the rightness or wrongness of it, I'm not saying that, but I am saying I think persecution is clearly wrong, and the Covenanters were against that, but they weren't against promoting the church with the government and things like that. And again, it's looking back on it, it's hard to get behind that, get our eye, you know, focus on that, but it was what it was, and it's cause for this pause and think about it. Any other comments on that? The explanatory? At one point, you had to take that oath to get a passport. So if you were an RP missionary, you know, so you want me to read? I can read that. Yeah, you had it. Yeah, let me read that because it's interesting. This is that explanatory declaration that you would state before you took the oath. In taking this oath, I make no mental reservation. I am a member of the RPCNA, and I declare that I owe a supreme allegiance to the Lord Jesus Christ. But in making that declaration, I take the same God as my witness, invoking his assistance to help me to render due obedience to my country in all temporal matters. And I do further declare that I do not now know any manner in which I intend any actual disobedience to any command of my country now known to me. So it's sort of saying, so it's very, very legalese, I guess you could say, but it's interesting. So, and that's still, I mean, I think that's still, the church would have that and say, you might, you know, if because political dissent is now a matter of conscience. That's what the church says. It says there's people in our church that still want to dissent politically. And so they still give this as a recommendation. If you, in good conscience, can't take this oath, consider adding this explanatory declaration as a way to kind of ensure that you're not compromising your allegiance to Jesus Christ.